we're recording.
So are we going to do this with some sort of a structured approach or just ad lib, or how do we, you're going to ask questions and I'm going to ask, answer them?
He's going to ask questions.
I'll be asking the questions, and yes, there'll be some structure, and then we're going to have a little ad lib here
right.
and there.
Okay.
And so we're recording right now?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I am Eric Crick, and I am here with alumni 56.
Jim Bryant.
You were born, sir, on when?
February 21st, 1935, in San Diego, California.
Oh, good. And we are gathered here today on October the 8th of 2011. All right, so now, Mr. Bryant, when you first came to this school, what was your impression? And did they give you a tour or any sort around this campus?
When I came to the school, my parents dropped me off, having driven up from San Diego, and there was no tour that I can remember. Essentially, we were assembled, assigned rooms, and found our way from there. There was not much in the way of orientation that I can remember.
Oh, lucky you. We had to go through week-long orientations.
Yeah.
How did you hear about the school?
The registrar of my high school, which was Sweetwater Union High School in National City, California, a woman by the name of Grace Siebold, suggested that I considered the school. If I had not come here, I would have gone to San Diego State College in San Diego. But it looked like an opportunity, and it gave me the opportunity to get away from my environment in San Diego and get out of town, so to speak.
Just spread your wings?
Well, I think there's always the desire on the part of an individual who's a child in a family with adult supervision to escape that.
Yeah.
So I came to the California Maritime Academy, and I didn't escape the supervision, that's for sure.
Yeah. So what made you go into being an engineering major?
Well, I think you had 1 week to decide. And in that week, it was very obvious to me that the engineering area was the one of interest to me. I had no background in boats, no sailing experience. I did have experience with automobiles. So I think the automobile background as opposed to the boat background led me into the marine engineering. You just had two choices, either deck or engine. And you had 1 week to switch majors if you desired to do so.
Hmm. And because of your mechanical skills, I see from the Hawks Pipe, which you were a staff member of, correct?
I was the photography editor on the Hawks Pipe, yeah.
Okay. I saw a picture of you actually fixing your car, and they drew a little cartoon in there. So it's like, depending on what you did most of the time around here, is that what your cartoons were based off of? So since you're a mechanic and you're good with cars, you got that cartoon mechanic?
I think the cartoons were designed to be funny, and you had to have something. You'll find that they're all somewhat different. But I had two Model A Fords. I bought the first one, a 1931 Model A Ford, from a fellow by the name of H.H. Miller, who graduated in 1955. And I bought the car for $50. And sold it probably 3 years later for $50. And the cost of insurance, which I could only get through my parents' policy because I was 23 years old or thereabouts, 22, living away from home, male. Very hard to get insurance then, harder now. So the insurance cost $74. The car was $50, the insurance was $74. The next purchase that I made in the automotive area was for a 1929 Ford Model A, and that car I bought for $35 to get its tires. It had better tires than the tires that were on mine. So for a while I had two Model A Fords on campus and one set of license plates.
So
I'd have to shift the license plates back and forth between cars.
Was there ever a time you forgot to put a license plate on?
Luckily I did not. That I can remember. I do remember when I changed the tires on the car from the older tires that were on the 31 to the newer tires that I've obtained from the 29. I went to a gas station somewhere along, I think it's Solano Boulevard, the one that runs down there, and used their electric impact wrench to change the wheels off the car. And I was not familiar with that, and I didn't realize that I had not seated the lug nuts properly. So as I drove down Solano Boulevard, one of the tires came off. Well, the Model A was rigid enough that it didn't do anything more than sag a little bit on that side. But the tire bounced across the road and hit an outdoor advertising sign, smudging the cheek of the little baby in the Delsey tissue. In this.
And so what was the area like around here? Because when you drove in, you saw things like the gas stations nearby and the Vallejo Inn. Was this all just pretty much open area?
There were no gas stations and there was no inn. It was just bare, in my recollection. There was practically nothing here at the time except the school.
Just the school?
Yes, that my recollection is that you had to hike a long way to find civilization from here.
Okay, because we've also heard before the giant vacant lot that's just out there before the school, and it's basically between the school and the Vallejo Inn.
Yeah.
There used to be a sort of family restaurant there, but I take it that it wasn't there when you were here.
There was a bar at that time. My memory bank says that it was called Oogles, but whatever, it had a name, but there was a bar there. I don't remember a restaurant. There may have been a restaurant, but I don't remember it.
Okay, well, there was something standing there once. Did you guys go there frequently
for weekends? Well, actually, no. So far as my finances were concerned, they were minimal. We really couldn't afford to do much. The cost of going to school at that time, including tuition, room, and board, was $405 a year. And there was a subsidy from Maritime Administration of $200 a year. So, and when you arrived at school, you bought all the uniforms and books that you would need for the 3 years. So that was pretty much in place by the time you began to have a week-to-week experience. And I was on a budget of $40 a month. But I had to save $20 a month in order to have the necessary money for the next year's tuition. So even at the low cost of things in those days relative to the higher cost, in terms of the dollar, in those times, we didn't have much extra money, so it would be very hard to go anywhere and do anything because basically we couldn't afford it. Most of us.
Okay, and so you had to keep yourself busy and occupied around here then.
Yeah, a lot of time was spent in the swim pool and other physical activities. In terms of library, we have this wonderful library now. The library, when I first came here in 1953, I don't even remember where it was, or they probably didn't have more than a couple hundred volumes of books. At that time, there was a mess deck in that small parking lot immediately east of the administrative building parking lot. It's now a small parking lot. That used to be the mess deck.
Really?
And we did not have the mess deck.
That's currently over there.
Over here. And not in 1953. By the time I graduated, it was here. I can't tell you what year it was built. But the mess deck in 1953 was in that, what is now that parking lot. So when they built the new mess deck, the old mess deck was converted to a library.
Hmm. Okay. And so how much of the school do you see has changed, I mean, since your last visit here?
Since my last visit, it hadn't...
Or I guess your graduation.
Oh, well, if you begin in 1953, there was not a classroom building, not a two-story classroom building. It was built while I was here. So that happened when I was here, the mess deck and the classroom building. When I arrived, it's hard for me to remember where the classes were held, but there was a machine shop and some other educational opportunity between those three barracks, or maybe four barracks, and the administration building. But when I came here, or when we came here, there really was just the barracks, the administration building, something down near the water, including the boathouse, and the ship. That was that stream of buildings. And then over to the other, to the west, there was the swimming pool, the auditorium, and that was it. Very, very limited.
Okay, so things are actually pretty basic and sparse around here?
Yeah, there's a lot of dirt. There was dirt from the administration building to the ship, and all the way over to the swim pool.
Oh, was it all like an outdoor pool, or was it indoors?
It's the same pool.
That's the same pool.
Same pool. It's the same mess deck. It's the same pool. Those are the things that have been here for 50-some, almost coming up on 60 years. The only change in the mess deck is the addition of that small area on the east end, which is now perhaps for faculty or for use for meetings and things. Mm-hmm. That's the only addition of the mess deck since they was built.
Hmm.
And in that time, there were 125 students here. Now you have 850 or something like that. I'm just amazed.
Around that number, yeah.
Yeah, I'm just amazed that they can feed them all.
Oh, you'd be amazed, especially with what they serve us these days.
Yeah.
Yeah, and with regards to the ship,
yeah.
the ship you had, the Golden Bear 2.
No, it's a Golden Bear.
Or you're a Golden Bear.
Well, there are a total of four ships that have been used. The first ship was called the Golden State.
Okay.
And then that was probably from 1930, roughly, until 1946. In 1946, we got the Ex Molina. The AKA, the twin turbine, twin shaft ship, 1946. That was the first Bear.
Okay.
So when I say the Golden Bear,
you actually do mean the Golden.
Yeah, I mean,
Bear.
Yeah. It was. You wouldn't say. It's like if you say in 81, did they call that 81? Probably not. So it was just the Golden Bear. So if you look at the Golden State. And the Golden Bear, and then you had Golden Bear 2 and 3. Golden Bear 2 was a ship that was originally, well, for the Navy's standpoint, it's called the Crescent City. And the Golden Bear, the second Golden Bear, has the most, the richest history in that the ship that the Navy had as Crescent City that came here in 1946 was used in World War II and was used as a transport for the Marines who landed at Guadalcanal, and had numerous occasions to be involved in other amphibious operations as a troop ship for the rest of the war. She had been designed as a cargo passenger ship for the, I think it's called the Delta Lines.
Okay.
And I think she was originally called the, maybe the Delta Queen, although I'm confusing that with a paddle wheel steamer that was here in World War II. But anyway, the Navy called it the Crescent City. That ship, Golden Bear II, went out of service when the Ex Mare came into being around 1990, is my best estimation, 86, 90, somewhere in that time period.
Okay, and the Golden Bear, when you were here, what was life on the ship like when you was here? And you had your class on there. Did you guys have classes on the Golden Bear?
There may have been classes on the Golden Bear. Certainly practical. The practical work was done on the Golden Bear. In the morning, we had classes. I think you got up around 6 o'clock or thereabouts, and you had breakfast at perhaps 7. And then at 8 o'clock, you had a formation and went to class.
And did you have formation every day?
Every day. And then at 8 o'clock every morning was formation, and then you went to class. Then that went on until noon when you broke and went to lunch. And then after lunch, you went to wherever you lived and changed into dungarees for the practical activities in the afternoon.
Right. And how often did you guys take the ship out?
To my remembrance, we took it out just once a year for the cruise. The ship would go into a yard for a month, and then it would go on cruise. And we'd get back somewhere around Easter, so we must have left it around the 1st of February and came back somewhere towards the end of March.
Okay, and because of where we are, I mean, Mare Island is like about a few minutes' drive. Did you ever go to Mare Island?
I did not. I don't remember. We may have, but I don't remember any particular involvement with Mare Island.
Okay, but the school would. Did it have like some indirect involvement? I mean, would they allow students to go down and possibly, I don't know, do a side job or do a sort of internship around the docks, and that way they could actually work with ships?
Not to my memory. The routine here was that you were here until Friday evening, and then you'd be back Sunday evening with different hours depending on their class. Mm-hmm. I think that the seniors could get back at midnight, and earlier years got back at earlier times. So you were really restricted in terms of what you could do off campus.
Okay. Now, when you guys took your cruises, where were some of the ports that you'd gone to?
Well, we had three cruises, and the cruises in those days essentially were on the west coast of North and South America, pretty much the west coast of South America, except the one year that we went to Tahiti. The first year, the ship went first to Callao, Peru, and then to Valparaiso, Chile, then up to Acapulco and home. The second cruise went from Vallejo to Tahiti and back to Acapulco and home. The third cruise, because we'd exhausted our fuel budget, went to Panama Canal zone on the west port of Panama Canal, and then to Acapulco and home.
And out of all these various ports, which ones did you enjoy the most?
Valparaiso. I think that the influence of German culture in Chile is very large. In Peru, not so large. Not the same culture. I don't know where the culture is that colonized Peru. Perhaps it was Spanish. I was almost reason to assume a Spanish. Being further south in the southern hemisphere, Chile is a much more temperate climate. So Peru was hot. Valparaiso, very much like San Francisco. If you look at similar cities to Valparaiso, you'd be looking at Hong Kong and San Francisco.
Okay, and from the trip you took from Vallejo to Tahiti,
yeah,
you had to cross the equator for that, correct?
That was the second time that we'd crossed the equator, yes. The first time was going to Peru and Chile. All
right, and when you guys crossed the equator, did you do any sort of crossing rituals or like initiations?
Yes, very heavy duty. It was an opportunity for the various levels on the school ship to interrelate somewhat awkwardly, in that the senior class members had been across the equator before, so they were shellbacks and we were polywogs. So that gave the opportunity for us to go through a initiation procedure, which consisted of going through a chute that was full of garbage, and also going through a line of people who whacked you on your backside with typical implements of torture. And at some point then you had to make your obeisances to Neptune, who was the ship's cook, a very large black man who you had to kiss the cook's stomach. That was fun. And I remember one of our classmates, Harry McCullough, who was an older fellow who had some Coast Guard experience, he had a lot of chest hair, so he had to have a little trim of his chest hair. But that's the sort of thing that went on.
And did this happen like every time you went on the cruises?
Well, the first time you were a polywog to shellback, the next time you were the shellback. But I think that the third cruise, I don't think we crossed the equator, so we didn't. I believe that the equator is south of the canal zone.
Okay, and when you went through the initiations once, and then you guys did it again.
Yeah.
Which ones do you partake in the most when you were conducting the initiations? What were the activities you were involved in on the ship?
Well, you mean in terms of the equator crossing?
Yeah, in terms of the equator crossing, when you were not being initiated.
Yeah.
When you were not being hazed, that's a better word. What were you doing to haze the new guys?
Well, that was about it. There was the potential to have the polywogs take over the ship the night before, and that was sometimes successful, sometimes not. And as I remember it, there may have been some suggestion of breaking out the fire hoses and that sort of thing. I don't know if that ever happened, but I'm a little fuzzy in that area. But I can remember being the polywog the one year and the shellback the next.
Let's see. What were the some of the things you saw in the various ports? I mean, what can you remember about Tahiti?
Well, doing it sequentially, the first cruise, we went to Peru, and then Chile, and then to Acapulco. In Peru, it seems we met a professor or teacher of English who was anxious to have interrelationship with English-speaking people. So he gave us a tour of Callao and Lima. Callao is a seaport, and then Lima is the first major municipality inland. Then San Diego, I can remember being involved. There was a reception that the Chilean Navy put on for us, and then somehow they got to a little suburb called Viña del Mar, which is very attractive in Chile. So that was the first cruise. The cruise to Tahiti was interesting in that this was 1955. February of 1955, and the Bear was the first large ship that had come into Tahiti since World War II, so it was a big deal. And we had a reception by the mayor, and they had something called a tamara, which is like a luau, and we were feted very heavily. Tahiti at that time was just barely a tourist destination. There was one 12-passenger float plane came in every Thursday. That was it. I think today there are probably half a dozen 747s a day.
Probably.
So it was extremely small and extremely bucolic and tropical paradise. We were there for, I think, maybe 3 days, maybe four. And when we left, the ship backed down. And when the ship went into forward drive, the rear turbine, the casing, the upper casing on the rear turbine shifted somehow, lots of sparks and things. So we thought, oh, great, we'll be here for a long time while we get fixed this. But I think they fixed it within a day and we left. And then, of course, we went from Tahiti to Acapulco and home. The third year, as I said, we didn't have the fuel money, so we ended up just going to Panama, Acapulco, and back. And Panama was not a particularly nice place, you know.
How so?
Well, it was, if you were to compare Acapulco to Panama, you'd prefer Acapulco very much. Panama was extremely lower class in terms of everything. We had one member of the ship's company who got into some bad booze in Panama, and they ended up putting him in a hospital in Panama.
And I tell you, you don't want to go to the hospitals in Panama either.
Well, I mean, the thing is, the ship left without him.
Oh.
But it turned out that this fellow's name was Ted Lockwood, and he was Admiral Lockwood's son. Admiral Lockwood was a very well-respected admiral in the Navy, and when they let him know that his son had been left in Panama, he suggested they go back and get him, which we did.
Had he been anyone else, he would have just left him on
Left him
home.
In Panama, yeah.
Oh, it looks like you lucked out on that one.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was the common theme of things to do in these various ports? I mean, when you guys had a day of leave ashore,
yeah,
what were some of the things you guys would go and do?
Well, there were the local cultural sites to see. The cathedral in Lima and the catacombs of Lima, which had a lot of skulls and bones. You could take a side trip. I think they from in Peru, you could go to Machu Picchu to go up into those ruins. But the only people who did that had the money that could do it. So not too many people took those trips. I couldn't tell you what percentage did. And in Valparaiso, you could take the train to Santiago, which is the capital of Chile. So people did that. So yeah, there were things to do, cultural things. There are also you could go to restaurants and ashore, local night spots, that sort of thing.
Hmm. And let's see, did the curfews hold the same back then? I mean, just like how when you're here at school and you were gone for the weekend, you had to be back by a certain time. Was it the same thing as with crews? You know, if you were a graduating class member, you came back at a later time, early years, they had to be back earlier?
I don't remember that there was a graduated time that you had to get back, but you had to get back before 10 or 11 p.m., something like that. You could get back later, but you'd have to figure out some way to get aboard other than coming up the quarterdeck.
Yeah, we had a... For us, we actually had a whole curfew system set up, and it was if you got back to the ship before midnight,
right,
then they wouldn't breathalyze you, and this was even if you were drunk, but as long as you made it up the gangway,
yeah,
looking or acting sober enough,
right,
then you could actually go to your room with no questions asked.
Right.
But if you did show up, I mean, you could be as sober as a priest on Sunday,
but
they will still breathalyze you, because, like, why are you late?
Right, right. So those were the crews. The crews was the highlight of the year. But I think that the overriding motivation was to get through this experience as soon as possible and see CMA in your rearview mirror. That was the primary motivation.
Actually still is the primary motivation around here today.
Sure.
Yeah.
It's a high-stress experience, much more so now than then. I'm guessing that we were probably carrying around 12 units because we had 5 days of instruction a week, 4 hours a day. So we had 20 hours a week with very little in the way of outside preparation. I don't think that we had too much out-of-class things that we had to do.
And so when you're actually on campus, looking through the Hawks Pipe, and
yeah.
Does Hawks Pipe mean anything, or is that just something that you guys have thought of?
Oh, well, that's fairly simple. I guess it's the sailing ship here. But if this were a more modern ship, there would be an anchor hanging here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that anchor goes through a penetration of the hull, which is called the hawse pipe. So the hawse pipe is the opportunity for the anchor chain to let the anchor go into the water and anchor the ship. So, and if you... I think sometimes if you, they'll refer to individuals who've got their licenses by working the way up from oiler, fireman, wiper, etc., or I guess it's fireman, oiler, to a third assistant engineer or able-bodied seaman to a third mate. That would be called coming up through the hawse. So the hawse pipe is related to the anchor.
Hmm. Okay, and you were actually. Staff member of
the... Well, I was the photography editor, so most of the photos in here are photos that I took.
Oh, those are pretty good photos.
Well, this is offset lithography. It doesn't have the highest contrast that we'd like to have, but at least it was relatively inexpensive.
Huh. And I saw that you did a lot of other things around here. I mean, like you said, this place was pretty barren from like the administration to the ship, just a bunch of dirt.
Yeah.
Yeah. You were a manager for the softball team here?
Well, one of the advantages of being involved in the athletic area was that it gave you the opportunity to go off base. So if you were involved with extramural water polo, basketball, that sort of thing, that gave you the opportunity to leave the base. So that's why I got involved. Let's see what... I think I was the manager of the baseball team. I don't think I was the manager. Let's see what it was here. Okay, I was the manager of the basketball team. Well, that's all I'm giving credit for. So let's say I was the manager of the basketball team.
I was wondering, there was something in there about softball later on in the book, but
probably, yeah.
But either way, so you did this so you could get off the school,
right?
And you're also a member of the Propeller Club.
Yeah. Now the port of California Maritime Academy for the Propeller Club was something that gave you the opportunity to interface with industry primarily. I can remember inviting, as the president of the Propeller Club, I invited the business manager for the MEBA, Marine Engineers Benevolent Association. I invited him to come to the school. That was the first time any member of the union hierarchy had been on campus.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that must have been good. I mean, did you use Propeller Club to actually be able to network yourself and get out into the industry?
I don't think that that was the primary purpose. It was a professional organization, so it was essentially the professional aspect of the Merchant Marine that we were looking to get.